CMO Roundtable,
the podcast where we talk to CMOs and marketing professionals to find out what's working, what isn't, and how you can leverage their expertise to improve your marketing and conversions. Now, let's welcome our host, number one best-selling author and co-founder of Conversion Fanatics, Justin Christensen.
All right, welcome everybody to the CMO Roundtable. This is your host, Justin Christensen, and today we've got another amazing guest. Our guest today is the founder and managing director of Acceleration Partners and the founder and chairman of Brand Cycle. He's a serial entrepreneur with an exceptional track record and passion for growing revenue and profits for B2C-based companies. In demand by top brands and investing firms, he has an extensive experience in consumer, e-commerce, retail, online marketing, and ad tech industries, partnering with some amazing companies that you may or may not have heard of, such as Adidas, ModCloth, Reebok, Target, Tiny Prints, Gymboree, and Warby Parker. He's a regular contributor to Entrepreneur, Inc., and Success Magazine, writing on performance marketing, strategy, and culture. He's a recipient of the Boston Business Journal 40 Under 40 Award and Smart CEO Boston Future 50 Award. His Acceleration Partners has won numerous awards in excellence in culture, great places to work, and flexibility in advertising and marketing categories. So, Robert Glazer, how are you doing, my friend?
I'm good. Thanks for having me, Justin.
Well, thank you for being on the show. We always like talking with high-caliber individuals such as yourself, and we're excited to hear what you got to share with us today. So in just 30 seconds or so, can you kind of give a little history on what exactly is, where you got to where you are, what Brand Cycle is and Acceleration Partners, and just kind of fill our listeners in?
Sure. So I've been in the marketing, acquisition marketing space for probably almost 15 years now. Been extensively involved in consumer businesses and scaling up consumer businesses. And started to realize that, yeah, you could get funding and strategy, you need all those things. But really, what separated certain consumer businesses from others was a scalable and profitable acquisition strategy. And have worked across all parts of online marketing, but really are drawn to the ones that have a performance component and are win-win. Because really, with all the data we have in direct response marketing, it should be that way. So Acceleration Partners is a performance marketing firm. We manage and set up large-scale affiliate and performance programs for high-growth brands, really on the representing the retail side. We love the affiliate world because it's performance-based. And Brand Cycle is a company we spun off that's on the other side, which basically helps content publishers and influencers easily get connected to the affiliate ecosystem and makes more campaigns available to them on a performance basis where budgets are frankly unlimited as long as you hit that number. So the influencer marketing has gone through this kind of classic stages of under the radar, overly hyped, overpaid. I think now it's coming to a permanent equilibrium of yes, influencer marketing is valuable. It's really a form of affiliate performance marketing that's existed for a while. There's just the social component, but it's going to be measured and managed with some of the same sort of metrics that we've had over time. It's not going to get its own rules.
Nice. So you've worked with quite a few big brands, obviously, and have your hands in a lot of things. But is there anything that keeps you up at night in terms of marketing?
My book keeps me up at night. What keeps me up at night is some sort of crisis. I tend to think things don't shift as quickly as they're going to be. We're managing a lot of revenue, a lot of programs, a lot of great brands. I guess what keeps me up at night is some partner that we work with acting in a way that would be harmful to one of those brands, since that is the core sort of essence of what we do and our differentiator of having these really establishing these commission-based sort of mutually beneficial partnerships that are supposed to be transparent. Sometimes someone says, "Hey, this is what I'm doing," and then they do something else. and we're quick to crack down on that, but that's probably what would keep me up at night.
Oh, nice. So you and I have been around the game about the same amount of time. I'm in my 15th year right now. It's crazy. You talk about the Wild West kind of inception of the affiliate, quote, I'm going to use quote unquote affiliate marketing industry, because I know you typically prefer the performance partnership or performance aspect of it. But can you talk a little bit about kind of where it's gone and kind of bring us to where we are today?
Yeah, so I look at the evolution in sort of three phases. Gen 1, which was the first 10 years. Gen 2, which I think ended sort of about 2 years ago, 2015. And then really the most progressive programs that we've seen are launching Gen 3 programs, what we consider the performance partnership programs. But Gen 1 of affiliate marketing was like any sort of gold rush where, you know, the concept came out, pay for performance, commission based. This is great. You know, why wouldn't I want this? A lot of the folks in e-commerce at the time weren't really brands. If you thought anything like pets.com, drugstore.com, they were kind of just, you know, whatever the product was.com, and they didn't have brand departments. And I think so from this standpoint, and before people understood attribution, it was like, great, you give me revenue and a sale, it's good, I'll pay for it, I'm not going to ask any questions. I talked about in the book, like, I think it was the don't ask, don't tell era of marketing, where honestly you were working with these partners and they get upset if you ask them about their tactics because they thought that you were trying to steal from them. And what happened was there was just some really smart marketing entrepreneurs, and I think rather than it being win-win, they tried to find various loopholes. They tried to, you know, we're all over paid search and jumping ahead of their own retailers and pretending to be them paid search. So it's not that everything bad, but you had really smart marketing entrepreneurs jumping in as publishers and affiliates, doing a lot of arbitrage and searching paid search because companies just hadn't figured this stuff out. And they were making a lot of money, but I think a lot of the activities maybe weren't as incremental for brands. That sort of transitioned into Gen 2. The concept of attribution really comes to light in marketing. You know, in the book, when I use affiliate revenue, I always use quotes because people used to tell me their affiliate revenue was X. And, you know, what you had is every channel counting the revenue that they had a marker in and coming to the table and saying that was their revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And so every marketing department was just dramatically overcounting. And I think affiliate came under particular scrutiny because you could alter the payouts. You couldn't go back to Google and say, hey, I want my money back. So until attribution was really introduced into affiliate marketing, it was just all about volume and vanity metrics and no transparency. And then in Gen 2, these brands started coming online. I think people started looking at the network model and some of the inherent conflicts in that. And they started asking some questions about this revenue and where it was coming from and was it incremental. And they didn't like all the answers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so Gen 2 affiliate marketing really introduced attribution, looking into those numbers, not counting everything at face value, starting to question, hey, I have this publisher partner who's been running on my affiliate network for a while. I paid him $100,000 a year, and I don't really understand what they do. And you start to ask questions, and you can't get great answers. And really, the theme of all of this was that the retailers and the consumer companies created last-in-based models where they valued the last click, and affiliates and publishers became really good at becoming last-in. Inherently, that probably it was valuable based on what they were paying for. It wasn't probably valuable to the business, and we're actually seeing in Gen 3 starts, people really trying to move back to programs that really pay why they're interested in influencers, but they pay for awareness and top of funnel and people that aren't in the shopping cart and really shifting performance based to, you know, driving new and incremental demand to their programs.
Yeah, for sure. So where are you thinking it's going to go in the next 10 years?
I think, you know, particularly with everything that's going on in display right now and mobile display and the levels of fraud and when you don't really have performance, I think people are pretty fed up paying for stuff that doesn't work in digital direct response.
Mm-hmm.
And really, with all that data, you shouldn't be paying for stuff that doesn't work. And we're no better than the John Wanamaker, you know, I only know where 50% of my marketing works. I just don't know which 50%, which was about 120 years ago, I think he said that. So one of the key things that I think is happening is people are moving towards the concept of performance. They really want to pay for outcomes and tie performance to their partners. However, they want to do it in a different way. We see more in-house and direct programs, people licensing software as a service platforms, calling these partner programs, not affiliate programs, and sort of bringing all their different digital relationships under one management and technical umbrella, which is really the performance partnership framework, and saying, look, I can do business development at scale here. All these, if I'm a big company and I have these $5,000 or $10,000 business development partners that I'm turning down, really I should turn them over to my affiliate partner team and say, get these guys up on our platform and get them into a standardized program. They don't need customization, and they can accept the agreement, they can get links, they can start promoting, they can get their numbers in real time and get paid via direct deposit. And that really makes a lot of these relationships work at scale.
Yeah, awesome. So you talk about performance partnerships. In fact, I think you have it trademarked, if I'm not mistaken. So what is it? How does it differ from your traditional, you know, affiliate marketing type program?
Well, yeah, so it started with this discovery as I was writing the book and saying, look, I'm going to ask 20 people in the industry to define affiliate marketing and performance marketing and see if it's the same or it's different. And I got 20 different answers, but there were a few themes that led us to the performance partnership sort of discovery, which was the purists believe that there should be a CPA element, that that's what affiliate meant, where a lot of people say, oh, well, you know, paid social can be performance marketing if I can measure sort of cause and effect after the fact. I can't get my money back. And then there was so much of affiliate marketing. People say, I don't like that. Oh, it's deals and it's coupons. I don't know who I'm working with. And I say, well, that doesn't have to be affiliate marketing. So we said, well, what's the term that describes what everyone wants and excludes the stuff that they don't want and that has been a lot of the reputational problem for affiliate marketing? And so we came up with four elements that sort of constitute a performance partnership, which is sort of like, to us, is like Chianti Classico. Like it can only come from a certain region. Like, so if you want a performance partnership, it really has to have these qualities. And that's the CPA payout. So that came through, or COD, as I like to say, cash on delivery. So that came through loud and clear from the purists to say, look, you know, it's really performance when the payout is given when you get what you want, not when you can measure it after the fact. Two is transparency. So you know, everyone has access to the data and the reports. You know what your partner is doing. It's not really like this offer. It's an actual relationship, which is the third thing. So that you have a relationship or partnership. So when you're working with these folks, it's more of an ongoing relationship and not this transaction that's very adversarial. Or a lot of affiliate was, you know, you put out an offer and then those people rebrokered the offer and then they sold the offer and you don't have any idea who you're doing business with. So, you know, transparency and relationships eliminate that. And then this real-time tracking and payment. So when you're working with partners, you know, they should have real-time access to the data. They should see how they're doing. They should have the payment terms automatically set up. It eliminates all of this, hey, I'll give you a UTM parameter. You'll send me a spreadsheet. I'll send you an invoice. You send me a check. There's so many partner business development type agreements managed like that. That's crazy when you can roll those all into an affiliate network or a SaaS platform and operate much more effectively.
Yeah, marketers ruin everything.
it's actually not the marketers, right? So you'll have the marketing team that's sort of managing the affiliate program in a company. Then you'll have someone else that's managing this referral program that's gotten like way too large and is being used in one to many. Then you have the biz dev team that's doing some of these deals and setting up landing pages. And then you have these kind of direct partnership opportunities that find themselves to different people. And it just kind of makes a mess. And they're all the same thing. And they all should be managed in a cohesive way and organized. And then they should be tracked on the same system so that you don't have arbitrage. We recently had an issue with a client where they have a direct program. And we were recruiting a publisher, and they told us that one of the groups in the company, they could get a better deal through a rebroker than they could get going directly to the company.
Ouch.
And the guy was furious, too, because his job is to collapse all this stuff. And so now he's going around saying, look, who's making other offers? This is exactly why I don't want anyone to do this, because we shouldn't. The company, we should just have an offer. We shouldn't have 20 different programs. Most people don't need the level of customization that is required, right? So you say, hey, I want to work with you. I need a custom landing page. I need a this. I need a that. And you say, tell you what, we'll set you up in our system. You fill out the contract. We'll get you a link. You can direct it to whatever page you want, and it'll track. Let's see how that does.
Yeah.
let's see if you make some money with us, and then we'll talk about custom landing page. What happens is they work backwards, and they start creating all these custom landing pages, and then that person does $5 in sales, and then they call up the next year, and they say, I got a update that page and no one can find the page, and they're tracking down their $4 check, and it just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, absolutely does not make sense. So you talk about the Uberization of marketing. What does that mean, and what can brands learn from that? You know, companies like Airbnb, Uber. You know, I know everybody says I'm the Uber of something, or it's going to be the next Airbnb of something.
Be careful of business models where people use three other businesses to describe them.
Yeah.
But you know, this started with like sort of logo tournaments and 99 Designs, where you put sort of the wisdom out to the crowd. Mm-hmm. And this is sort of what we're seeing with companies. Rather than trying to be good at all aspects of marketing, they are creating these in-house networks or systems. And again, think of it, instead of Uber owning cars, they say, look, to be an Uber driver, you got to follow these criteria. You got to use our platform. You got to follow our rules. And we can scale pretty quickly because we don't need to hire drivers and buy cars and do it everywhere. We just need to create the platform that makes us operate. Mm-hmm. And I think that logo tournament concept is being taken to the next level, where people are opening up their marketing to partners. And they're saying, look, we have this system. We have this tracking platform or our partner program. You have to adhere by our brand standards. We have to know what you're doing and transparent. But if you know how to do something really well, we're happy to have you do that for our company and do it on a performance basis. And if you think about how quickly things are changing, you know, by the time you get the Facebook expert, you need the Instagram expert. Now you need a Snapchat expert. And the marketing teams are sort of chasing their tails. Affiliates are really good marketing entrepreneurs. Like they, mm-hmm. they will come to your program if they know how to do something, and they know how to do one thing really well, rather than being employed by you or elsewise, they can come join your program and deliver that. So I think you'll see more of these companies, again, setting up really these marketplaces for their marketing, where people can come in, and if they know how to do a thing really well or better than the company, have better data, they can do that and do well. And the company is very happy to pay for outcomes and not inputs.
Yeah, absolutely. We're seeing it quite a bit too in the optimization space as well.
Yeah.
So what's your thoughts on the fake news craze that's going on right now and how that affects affiliate marketing?
Yeah, look, it's a little scary. So I was recently asked to come on the Dr. Oz show with Barbara Corcoran for an episode they did on fake news. And Dr. Oz is just really frustrated. So, you know, a lot of people think he sells products. He doesn't sell any products. What happens is he talks about something on the news, and then publishers, usually working for companies that have affiliate programs that offer 50% commission, selling pretty, you know, scammy products and who look the other way, say, look, we'll just pay 50% for our, you know, $70 a month Miracle face cream. We're not going to ask any questions how you got it from. And so he was getting really frustrated, all these companies and people endorsing his products, and figured out that a lot of them were publishers. So it wasn't actually the company themselves. It was publisher who just spun up a fake news site, bought a paid search ad on Facebook or Instagram. And in this instance on the show, you know, they follow this whole value chain through, you know, an ad appearing on Facebook, endorsing some cream that Barbara Corcoran, was supposedly endorsed that she had nothing to do with, and totally using her likeness. And they find the owner of the company, and, you know, he of course says, oh, this is terrible, but he blames his affiliates. And so they really want to understand how this works. So, I affiliates did a lot of stuff with paid search. I mean, most of them are good. There's definitely some bad ones. With paid search and otherwise, fake, you know, to get traffic, right? Fake news is kind of the new traffic source. So what's kind of scary is I can target people based on their persona. So, mm-hmm. I can, people who apparently maybe have an acne problem or a weight problem, you know, I can actually target them as a marketer. I can spin up, buy a paid social ad. I can spin up a page that kind of looks real, includes an endorsement. And this is stuff that brands really need to be careful of. And this is why a sort of a set it and forget it affiliate program is never a good idea, because you really can be liable for the behavior of your affiliates. And the FTC has come down on that and is increasingly enforcing that.
Yeah, it's those turn and burn people. So Dr. Oz says something about, you know, Garcinia Cambogia, and then all of a sudden everybody and their brother has a Garcinia and Cambogia supplement. Ooh.
Endorsed by him,
and they've got, you know, whatever, men's health, quote unquote men's health, something link with this article saying that, then the black market of Facebook accounts and all of that fun stuff.
Right. someone like GNC is susceptible to this because, like, you know, a very legitimate company running affiliate program can have an affiliate that says something like that and makes it up. But if you look on the flip side, a lot of time they are these programs that are not very well, you know, run, or brands that are fly by night, and they're on these lead gen networks and they're offering ridiculous payouts, right? Mm-hmm. So the only way to offer a 60% product on a, you know, a commission on a product is that product has a ton of margin. Well, why does it have a ton of margin? Because it's probably just like, you know, CVS brand face cream, you know, branded as some miracle thing that you're selling for $60 a month, which was the case in this thing on Dr. Oz, where people would get on the subscription for this cream and they couldn't get off. And I think they looked at it and said it was basically just, you know, $2 cream that you could buy at the store. It had no magic benefits.
Yeah, burn through some merchant accounts.
Yeah, exactly. But again, the merchants, you can have, it goes both ways. You can have a reputable merchant be susceptible to this because they're just not paying attention. They've trusted someone else to pay attention to their publishers who has a volume-oriented goal. So they love sales, so they're not going to look for this stuff. Or they intentionally are not looking, right? They are. If I were to have a product that was $200, paid 90% commission, and I looked the other way, the marketplace will take care of itself.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, that's awesome. And I guess that's the reason why you're in business too, is to really help people navigate those waters.
Yeah, it's funny. We're a little bit of like, I'm like a self-deprecating lawyer. I mean, I think we love the affiliate space. It's the majority of our business, but I think we're appropriately critical of it well, because the industry has not worked well together. It's worked sort of as a bunch of independent factions with a lot of competitiveness. And I think it's important that those who work in the highbrow parts of the industry and the quality parts say, look, this is not affiliate marketing. This is not what we do. This is not acceptable. The industry has done a really poor job of getting people to come together and sort of self-regulate. It just seems like, you know, one guy's trash is another man's treasure, or it becomes a competitive advantage that someone markets against, rather than everyone saying, look, this is bad. How do we root it out of the industry?
Yeah, great points. So I want to shift gears just slightly and go kind of into the marketing angle a little bit. But are there any like big wins, big marketing wins you've seen in the last year that jump out at you?
In our business or in general?
In general.
You know, I love the new Volkswagen ad. It makes me laugh every time.
Have you
seen the one where you keep getting a new car?
Yep.
I think, you know, what it stresses to me, and there was a video that I saw online from some photo book company that went crazy viral. It did as well since you know, going to make photo books, and that she wasn't a superhero and couldn't do this stuff, and it sent you photo books automatically.
Yep, the one with she started out in the bathtub.
Yeah. Right. That was probably the best thing I've seen since the Dollar Shave Club ad. And I think what all these things have in common, I think what people are realizing is we become over optimizers in marketing and sort of over measurers. And really, you know, there's digital and technology, there's measurement, but like you need good creative at the end of the day, mm-hmm. and you got to take risk. Right. So imagine that the person doing, and look, this goes a little too far on the brand side. You know, we want to spend $12 million and we'll see if it works. But I always said, imagine the Dollar Shave guy pitching that video originally and someone saying, oh, well, what do you think the ROI is going to be? Oh, well, if you can't tell us exactly what the ROI is going to be, you know, we're not going to do it. So there's so much measurement in marketing that I think people are inherently, I mean, you should take measured risks, but it's killed a lot of the creativity. There really needs to be some balance of getting this creativity, and everyone's focused on audience, but the message that the metaphor that I give is like, I could put you into a perfect room with your 100 perfect targets, you know, with 100 people that you would want on this show, put you up on stage, and you could bomb the speech, right? And,
yep.
and get none of them to come on your show. So this focus on sort of audience and segmentation and getting in front of the right person, but then get in front of them with what? You need a good message. You need to be creative. I think it's gone a little too far to the science side, and I think programmatic has shown this. Though, just trust the computers, you know, hasn't worked out too well in a lot of this display marketing. So the stuff that's really stood out for me in the last year has had that creative element and hasn't had a lot of money behind it. It's been really good content that's gotten spread organically.
Yeah, Dollar Shave Club, he said he recorded that in one take. I heard an interview with the founders of Squatty Potty too, and their ad, and they said that they were nervous to put it out there because it did cost a little bit more to put it out there, but it basically made them the brand they are.
Yeah. And look, they couldn't even repeat it, right? I mean, yeah, they tried.
So, I mean, one of our former clients is Poopery as well.
Yeah.
And their big viral ad that kind of started it all.
So it's lightning in a bottle. So I hear a lot more CMOs talking about going to catalogs, going, you know, offline, you know, focusing more on creative that is designed to, you know, not click on, but get the right emotion and brand alignment. And even like, you know, big topic is putting 10 to 20% of their budget into just R&D. Mm-hmm. You know, every time someone asks me, I'm sure you have this frustration, Justin, but every time someone asks me for the ROI of something before we do it, I tell them that if I knew that, I really wouldn't be here talking to them. I'd be on an island in Tahiti, you know, enjoying my retirement if I knew exactly how everything was going to work out. I think what you need is the measurement to know if and how it's working and to not lose your shirt, but you can't guess how everything's going to perform in advance.
No, I would be a heck of a lot wealthier if that was the case. People ask me all the time, can you predict if how much I'm going to get improvement on these split tests? Like, no. If I could get 100% winner every time, I would be in a much different place.
I can tell you what I'm going to look at and how I might think about success. But I don't know. Maybe your product's terrible. So there's a lot of – but, you know, I point out those examples. It's funny. You had seen all of them. Mm-hmm. You know, other than Volkswagen who paid for that ad, I mean, a lot of the good content just gets shared. The stuff that seems organic and – the harder people try and the more they put money behind it, sometimes it seems like the worse the product is.
And the bigger the brands, the bigger issues you see there too.
Yeah. I mean, it is, I've seen just some amazing campaigns that cost $1 million and got, you know, $200 million of sort of ad value because they were just good. Mm-hmm. and people shared them, and then other people who took some mediocre product or content and tried to put $100 million of marketing behind it, and it didn't work.
Yeah, for sure. So do you have any biggest lessons that you've learned in the last year?
I think it's this combination. I think we tend to swing too much one way or the other. You know, our business is really predicated on good technology, but good relationships. You know, you can be working with one of your partners and need to make a change to their terms. And the way that you communicate that to them can mean they never work with you again or they're willing to adjust. Mm-hmm. So it's really, the data is important there, but it's not all about that. And similarly, what I was saying about kind of the creative and the technology. So I think that in the last year, I think the realization that the robots were going to run all of marketing has sort of been disproven. And it seems like, you know, people are kind of backing off from that a little bit and looking for more creativity and discussion and, you know, bringing a little bit of the human element back to marketing.
I agree wholeheartedly. In fact, I'm putting together a presentation to do a talk next week. And mine is all about that doesn't matter what you're selling. We're dealing with people.
Yeah.
And I think those relationships matter. If you had one tip for people in their marketing, what would it be?
Focus. I think the successful companies, and then I'll put an asterisk to that.
Okay.
So the successful companies I've seen really figure out a channel or two and master it. And again, if you had $10, they put $8 in that one channel and they make it work. Other companies put a dollar into 10 channels and they have really weak offerings across too many channels. Unless you have a massive marketing department or you have a huge affiliate performance program where people can do this stuff for you, I see companies spread too thin. Every time people focus, they tend to do better. The asterisk on that is that at some point, that if that is your whole bet, and particularly, and we've seen this pattern across e-commerce companies dramatically, that is your whole bet and you raise a lot of money and people are expecting you to grow 10x, you will, the golden goose will not have enough eggs at the end of the day, and you will need to do other stuff. So I've seen people then take it too far and they get arrogant. They say, well, no, I don't need to test this other stuff because we just mastered Instagram. Well, they've now raised money and promised their investors they were going to be 10 times bigger in 2 years. So they need to figure out and start testing that other channel. So I do think that – I think focus gets you really much better results, but you need to be experimenting and you need to not over-rely on something that, frankly, may have worked last year but may not work next year.
Awesome. So that's actually all the official questions I have for you. So again, I really appreciate you being on the show. How can folks connect with you if they want to find out more about you?
Sure. You can find me at the Acceleration Partners website, which is accelerationpartners.com. You can also go to the Performance Partnership book site, which is performance-partnerships.com. We just launched the first couple of chapters up for free, and we have a cool tool on there called Affiliate Grader, which can answer a couple of questions over 3 or 4 minutes, and we'll give you a score on your program and tell you what you can improve. And then, or you can find me on my personal site, which is robertsglazer.com.
Awesome, awesome. So again, Bob, thank you for being on the show, and we'll link everything in the show notes so everybody Great. Can find you. And that's all we got for you today, folks. If you could be so gracious as to like, comment, share, and check out some of our other episodes, we'd greatly appreciate it. And again, check out Acceleration Partners or check out his affiliate Grader at performance-partnerships.com and get the first couple chapters of his book. And thank you again, Robert, for being on the show.
Thanks, Justin.
All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk again soon.
Thanks so much for listening to the CMO Roundtable. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to rate us, subscribe, and give us a share. For more information about how you can accelerate your marketing results and to request your in-depth conversion analysis, visit conversionfanatics.com.